Hey guys, welcome to this week's episode of Lost Origins, your number one radio show for all things ancient mystery, alternative historical theory, and lost civilizations. Check us out online at lost-origins.com and make sure that you sign up for that free newsletter. We love interacting with you guys via email and on the site, and we also want to make sure that we are always keeping you in the know of new episodes and new articles from your friends here at Lost Origins. You guys can also connect with us on almost every single social media platform. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. So make sure that you hit that subscribe button. This week's episode of Lost Origins is brought to you by Inner Traditions and Baron Company. Inner Traditions has been publishing books on esoteric philosophy, New Age spirituality, alternative health, and ancient mysteries for well over 40 years. Go over to their website at innertraditions.com. You guys can learn more about their books, their authors. You can also sign up for coupons, catalogs, and special offers. Some of my all-time favorite books have come out of this publishing house, and we highly recommend them here at Lost Origins. So go check them out. Pick up one of their books. You will not be disappointed. This week's episode is going to be incredibly interesting, you guys. It's all about myth. Right? So this week we're going to be joined by researcher and author David Matheson. David's research surrounds the world's myths, ancient scriptures, and sacred traditions, but also their connection to the stars. David has authored several books, including Undying Stars, The Matheson Corollary, and most recently, Star Myths of the World, both volumes 1 and 2. Today, we're going to be discussing his research, his theories surrounding celestial metaphor, and what this means for humanity right after the break. All right, ladies and gentlemen, and we are back. If you're just joining us, this week we are going to be chatting with author and researcher David Matheson. David has spent years researching the celestial connection between the heavens and the ancient myths and scriptures of the world. David was recently recognized and awarded the title of Author of the Month by Graham Hancock, and David has authored several books, including Undying Stars, The Matheson Correlation, and Star Myths of the World, both volumes 1 and 2. So this week we are very excited to welcome David Matheson to the show. David, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Andrew. I'm excited to be here.
Well, the pleasure is all ours. First off, congratulations on receiving Author of the Month from Graham Hancock. That has to be, that's got to feel pretty incredible.
Oh, thanks. Well, Graham is actually highlights authors every month, and he's very gracious with his website. You know, he has articles written by other people, and he says, I don't want this website to be just about Graham Hancock. And I think that's really, you know, obviously for someone of his stature and who's written so much and influenced so many people, including myself, with the things that he's written, you know, I think that's very you know, gracious of him to have others over and to say, look, this conversation needs researchers looking at things from all different angles. It's like a gigantic jigsaw puzzle, and we're all looking at it from our own particular strengths and weaknesses. We all have our own different personalities and backgrounds and interests and fields of study that maybe we've spent more time in or whatever. So I think it's kind of like, you know, I've compared the mystery to like a Sherlock Holmes mystery, how he comes in. You know, a lot of times the conventional story is already, hey, we've got this crime all figured out and we don't really want Sherlock Holmes. Why are you showing up? Because we know you're going to throw a monkey wrench into our storyline.
Right.
But and it's often, you know, people kind of from the outside in these mystery stories who bring a different perspective. But I've also said it's kind of like a more like Scooby-Doo, because once again, they're kind of from the outside. But in the Scooby-Doo, it's not just one Sherlock Holmes. It's Well, we need the special talents of Shaggy and Scooby and Velma and Fred and Daphne. They all have their own different kind of quirks. And so it takes all of them kind of working together to stumble across. Thanks for that. So yeah, I was the author of the month actually back in 2012. And then with my first book, and then I had an opportunity to return this past March. So you can go on and take a look at some of the conversations there. But
very cool.
I was very grateful to get a chance to do that. And it's also an interactive thing where people's questions help you to consider things from different perspectives, or they'll offer a different perspective, and something always comes out of the mix. Mm-hmm. It's like something rises out of the interaction of many people that can't be created all by one person.
Right. Creative collaboration.
Right.
Yeah. I think that's incredible. Well said. Well, David, before we dig in and we start discussing star myths of the world, I think that it would be beneficial for you to provide our listeners with a bit of your background, right? How did you become involved with researching these ancient myths to the point where you chose to not write just one book, but two volumes on them?
Great, sure. Well, I think probably like a lot of your guests and maybe like yourself also, this is something that I was fascinated with really from a very early age. I remember in first grade being fascinated by ancient Egypt and making mummies. I think we had a project of making mummies out of masking tape around popsicle sticks. Uh-huh. And I made like hundreds of mummies. Got to see the King Tut exhibition when it came actually in the 70s to San Francisco, and was really fascinated by that. But I've also always been fascinated by the myths and the stars. I think I should mention that the star outlining or constellation outlining system of H.A. Rey is actually very important, in my opinion. And H.A. Rey, of course, you may, and your listeners may be familiar with H.A. Rey as the author of children's books, the Curious George books. Mm-hmm. But he also wrote a book called The Stars, A New Way to See Them in the 50s that talks about the method of envisioning these constellations in your mind that is at once practical and also lines up with what the figure is actually supposed to be representing, which a lot of the modern systems, even if you look up a constellation today on Wikipedia, like Leo or Virgo, you'll look at the outline that they give you and say, what, how could that be a lion? Or what, that's a beautiful maiden? I don't understand. Well, H.A. Rey also had that complaint, and he created a great system of outlining. And anyway, I was introduced to that by my father at an early age. We would go out and look at the stars, and I was in the Army for a long time, spent a lot of time out in under the night sky, shivering, lying on the ground. looking up at the stars. And anyway, I became very fascinated by the book Hamlet's Mill, which I'm pretty sure I first read about in a Graham Hancock book. Uh-huh. And they talk about the evidence that the myths of the world encode celestial cycles. And that was fascinating to me. But I didn't really want to apply that to the stories in the Bible. They once in a while in Hamlet's Mill will talk about, oh, and this seems to relate to this detail in the book of Genesis. And I would say, well, I believe that the Bible at that time, I believed that the Bible was meant to be understood literally. Uh-huh. So I kind of resisted that, but I was very familiar with the Bible. I was taking it literally and reading it, very carefully and seriously. And actually, when I wrote my first book, The Matheson Corollary, I was still taking the Bible literally. So you can see a kind of a change in my approach over the years.
Sure.
But as I looked at, I was very interested in the way that they were applying it to the Greek myths or the Norse myths or the myths of ancient India, etc. But as I saw some of the correlations with the biblical stories, I had to say, wait a minute, there does seem to be some there's quite a few correspondences here. And when you start to see more and more and more data points, and I know you've talked about this on your show, it's like, well, you can kind of ignore one or say, well, this is a coincidence, or maybe, yeah, that happened on Earth, and it just so happens to match up with the constellations. But because I was very familiar both with the stars and with the Bible, I started to see, wait a minute, this actually, from first to last, from the story of Adam and Eve in the garden to the events in the Revelation, you can see that they're actually based on a system of celestial metaphor. So anyway, you asked kind of how I got into this. It wasn't really something that I was looking for. When I wrote the Matheson Corollary, I was interested in the evidence that the Earth has undergone some catastrophic flooding, which is obviously talked about in the Bible. It's talked about in the myths of Mesopotamia. In fact, just about every culture around the globe.
Yeah, it's
there's
everywhere.
A lot of, you know, yeah, there's evidence undersea, deep canyons like the Monterey Trench, very hard to account for with uniformitarian geology. They try and say, well, maybe some currents carved these things out, turbidity currents. It's really clear that there was a massive runoff. There's fossils in Antarctica. So I was looking at the evidence of a catastrophe on Earth and saying maybe somehow these myths may relate to that. Maybe the rotation of the Earth, there's some evidence that the Earth actually rolled on its axis and Antarctica rolled down to its present location, because we have like palm trees and large dinosaur skeletons in Antarctica that you couldn't really feed those dinosaurs with the, you know, even if Antarctica was a little warmer. But anyway,
sure.
So at first I was approaching all these questions that I was very interested in from a literal perspective of the Bible. And later I had to realize, you know, I'm going to have to change my perspective on the way the Bible is supposed to be understood. So I've gone through some pretty large perspective or paradigm shifts in my own thinking.
Sure. Well, I think that you can see that trend happen with any researcher. You know, I mean, there's researchers and authors all across the world that, you know, what they started with, that concept, it goes through an evolutionary process, right? And so I think it takes, you know, balls almost to say, hey, what I thought 10 years ago, it turned out to not actually be that. But here's where my evidence and my research has actually led me to, you know, this new evolution of the theory. So well said. I want to discuss your books, Star Myths of the World, Volumes 1 and 2. I've found these very intriguing. I've also read online that these are massive tomes that you put a lot of work into. Can you explain the basic premise of these books for our listeners?
Sure. So this is actually a multi-volume project, and it's called Star Myths of the World and How to Interpret Them. And really, as I was kind of saying before, I believe that the myths are actually speaking to us in a language of metaphor, and they actually speak on many, many layers. There's many levels of meaning in the myths of the world, the sacred stories of the world, the ancient scriptures that have been preserved, whether those are the biblical scriptures or the scriptures of ancient India, other scriptures that have survived from ancient times, or the traditions, sacred traditions that are still that have survived in some cultures that were not destroyed or suppressed until more recent centuries. So there's actually a unifying common system of celestial metaphor that you can find operating in all these myths around the world. And that right by itself, just to say that, is obviously controversial. To say, wait a minute, how could myths that are found in the middle of the Pacific Ocean be related to the system of metaphor that might be operating in the myths of ancient Egypt or ancient Mesopotamia or ancient India, you know, or the myths that are found in the Americas. Okay, so, but you can find this common system operating throughout the myths. And so what I am setting out to do in these books is to show evidence that that is actually the case, to say, look, there's no way for me to exhaustively treat every single myth from even the Greek myths in a single volume. My volume two is all about the Greek myths, and it's 700 pages, and there's still so many more. We could do a whole volume just on the Heracles or Hercules myth. We could do a whole volume just on the Odyssey. Wow. But and show the celestial. So what I'm trying to show is A, that this is taking place, this is actually happening, and B, to show the reader how you can start to learn this language, because it's like these myths are coming to us from another country, that's speaking another language. Mm-hmm. And if somebody says, I speak that language, but they don't really speak that language, they could have a lot of fun with you. They could say, oh, he said this, you know, this visitor from another country and you don't speak their language comes to your house and the translator tells you they're saying this or that, but you don't speak their language.
Right.
They could say, oh, he said your cooking is terrible. And you're like, oh, really? And he's smiling because he tried to give you a compliment, but unbeknownst to him, the translator is sabotaging whatever he's saying. So what would be best is if you could learn some of that visitor's language, he or she, and speak to them yourself.
Right.
And say, hey, what are you trying to tell me? And that's what these myths are actually, they're speaking to us on many different levels, but one of the levels is definitely the level of celestial metaphor. And I'm not claiming that I know that everything about this language, but I have been studying it and learning more of its vocabulary and saying, this is interesting. Look at this across, here it is in the myths of the Pacific, and here it is in the Old Testament, and here it is in a myth from ancient Greece or in the Norse myths. And so I'm trying to show the reader how to do that. And those are the two main purposes. But the third thing is to show that when you do speak this language, or when you start to look at them in this way, mm-hmm. you will find new insights and new messages coming to you from the myths that you never saw before. It's sure. really, I believe it actually really unlocks some new insights. As I've said in my blog and I think in the introduction to volume two, I've taught the Odyssey at the college level. I had the opportunity I was in the Army and I taught at the military academy at West Point.
Oh, wow.
And I love the Odyssey. I've loved the Odyssey since I was little. I've, you know, read the Odyssey in lots of different translations, not in the ancient Greek. I don't claim to be a scholar of these languages. I haven't read ancient Greek, but, and I thought the Odyssey was amazing, and there's many wonderful messages in there that I was teaching and bringing out in these classes. But I didn't know anything about the celestial metaphor at that time. When I look at it through these new eyes of the celestial metaphor, I find new amazing things in there that it unlocks even more. So that's the purpose of those two volumes.
Very cool. Let's get an example. So, because in the book, you're connecting ancient myths, scriptures, sacred traditions to the stars, and how you found evidence of that across the globe, right? So let's actually talk about maybe one or two of these myths, depending on how much time we have. One myth, after visiting your site, that I found very intriguing, that I wanted to get your explanation of and your interpretation of, was the myth and celestial connection to that of Lord Krishna. Can you speak to that for us, please?
Sure. So that's a great one. And the myths of ancient India, you know, Krishna is one of the most powerful deities in the pantheon of ancient India. And he is one of the central figures in one of the two big Sanskrit epics, which is called the Mahabharata. It's spelled like Mahabharata.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I'm not a Sanskrit scholar, so I may not pronounce it correctly. But anyway, it's the great story of the Bharat family, of ancient India, and it talks about a tremendous battle on the plain of Kurukshetra between these two sides of this family, the sons of Pandu, the Pandavas, and the Kurus, the Kauravas. They're all actually cousins, and they're fighting against one another. It's like the Trojan War in the Iliad. And inside the Mahabharata is the Bhagavad Gita, is a specific subsection or portion of that larger epic. And the Mahabharata and the Ramayana are the two Sanskrit epics, and they are very, very massive. They're, many times longer than the Odyssey and the Iliad combined. And in them, you can see these celestial patterns being played out in all these different stories and incidents and episodes over and over in different ways. Well, anyway, so Krishna is one of the deities, and he is specifically helping one of the sons of Pandu, whose name is Arjun. It's usually spelled Arjuna. It's often pronounced with that A at the end is often silent.
Sure.
Anyway, Arjun. So Arjun is getting ready to go into this great battle. I could spend the rest of our time together talking about how this battle came to be and how the blind father of the Kurus, he doesn't restrain his evil sons from overstepping their bounds and continuing to humiliate the sons of Pandu, and the sons of Pandu try and avoid the battle in every single way that they can, and they try, but the sons of the Kurus will not be stopped, and they just keep they just think they're going to win the war, and they just keep trying to bring this war on. So at the very eve of battle, Arjun is getting ready to go into the battle, and Krishna has agreed to be his divine charioteer. They're going to fight in these chariots, these war carts. They're going to, be shooting arrows from their chariots at one another. And Krishna, there was actually an interesting scene where the bad guy brothers, they could choose either thousands of divine warriors, or they could have Krishna on their side. And the bad guy, the leader of the bad guy side, says, "Oh, I want the 1,000 warriors, of course. Thanks for letting me pick first." And
right.
Arjun says, "Great, I get to choose Krishna." And Krishna says, "Oh, and by the way, I'm not going to actually fight. I will just be a non-combatant charioteer." So anyway, Krishna is the divine charioteer in the Mahabharata, in the great battle of Kurukshetra, in the Bhagavad Gita, which means the song of the Lord, and that's the Lord Krishna, is actually on the eve of battle. Arjun doesn't want to go into battle. He wants to remain out of the battle. He's having second thoughts. He says, "You know what? I don't want to fight against my cousins and my uncles and my martial arts teachers from when I was young, and there's going to be so much death and destruction. I think I'll just drive out into the middle of the battlefield and sit down, and if the other side kills me, then at least I won't have killed anybody else." And Krishna talks to him, and he says, "Arjun, you do have to go into this battle. It's actually the right thing for you to do." And that's the Bhagavad Gita is actually that conversation. So also just as a side note, Arjun is one of the most powerful fighters on his side. He has gone up to heaven and gotten all these celestial weapons, which is very interesting that the weapons, they're heavenly weapons. Okay. So the stars in some way can be weapons for us on this battlefield of life. I don't mean necessarily actual weapons of violence. And this whole battle, actually, I believe, is not to be taken literally. And people say, "Oh no, well, we know where the plain of Kurukshetra is." Well, I would say that just like the Trojan War, this is actually about our experience on this battlefield of life, the interchange between light and dark that happens throughout the year, the cycles of the zodiac and the cycles of the seasons and the other heavenly cycles, the daily cycle, the moon cycles, they all actually have spiritual things to tell us about our own, that have very practical things to help us with in our own interplay on this battlefield of life. Well, we can set that aside for a minute, but what I was about to say is Arjun not wanting to go into battle is actually a pattern that we see in other myths. You may remember in the Trojan War that the greatest warrior on the side of the Greeks, who is Achilles,
right,
gets insulted and says, I'm not going to play. I'm taking my ball and I'm going to go sit in my tent and you guys can try and fight this battle without me. Ha, ha, ha. And the Greeks get pushed all the way back to their ships by the Trojans. Okay, this has to do, the great cycle of the year goes down to the winter solstice. That's when the days of daylight get pushed all the way back to their ships, so to speak.
Right.
The days become so short that, you know, it's getting dark at 4 p.m. That's the darkest part of the year. And then the sun starts to move back up the cycle of the zodiac, and we get all the way up to the summer solstice when the light is triumphing. Okay, so Achilles withdrawing from the battlefield. We have Arjun saying, you know, I don't think I'm going to participate in this battle. We have in ancient Japan, there's a goddess who is the shining light of heaven, who goes and locks herself away in a cave, and all the other gods have to, and goddesses and celestial powers have to come and get her to come out. This is a pattern that we find in myths over and over and over again. Anyway, so to specifically tie it into the constellations, so it is these cycles of the year, but these myths always include clues that show us that they are actually tied to specific constellations, such as Arjun is a great bowman, and Krishna is the divine charioteer, mm-hmm. and they have this war cart that is like a chariot. It's got four wheels, and Krishna is going to be the charioteer of that cart, and at the top of it is this mystical banner. It's a banner that's so long, it's endless. And it's got another god on it. I don't know if your listeners maybe are already supplying the answer in their minds, but there's a god on the banner who's the monkey king or the ape god, who is Hanuman or Hanuman. And he's a god that figures prominently in the Ramayana, the other great Sanskrit epic. Uh-huh. He carries a mace. He has an upraised tail. Okay, so now I'll tell you some of these constellations just to wrap this up. So first of all, there is a constellation in the sky that almost everybody's familiar with that we call the Big Dipper,
right,
the Great Dipper, the plow. And very close to the handle, the long handle of that dipper, there's a constellation called Boötes. He's the herdsman. He's actually one of the first constellations you're introduced to in the books of H.A. Rey, The Stars, A New Way to See Them.
Okay.
He has actually a long pipe coming out of his mouth. It looks like a long pipe, and the pipe comes very close to the handle of the Big Dipper. And Boötes, the herdsman, has the bright red star Arcturus in his hip. And so you can actually draw an arc. They say, you know, follow the arc to Arcturus. An arc off of the handle of the Big Dipper points down to his bright red star. Well, he's actually kind of hunched over. He's got this pipe that almost connects to the handle of the Big Dipper. He's the charioteer in many different myths around the world. Actually, in the Iliad, many charioteers are speared and killed on the battlefield. They're speared right through the face.
Wow.
And the Iliad will describe it, you know, in graphic detail. They'll say, then the spear went in through his cheekbone and his brains spilled out inside his helmet. And you're like, why did they have to say it in so much detail?
Right.
Well, they're pointing out, they're giving you clues that this figure that they're talking about is related to that constellation in the sky. He has a pipe that goes into his, that protrudes from his mouth. Well, that pipe can also be envisioned as a weapon going into his head.
So interesting.
In the Iliad, the way that a character is killed will tell you often which constellation they're talking about.
Okay, wow.
So that's a sidetrack. But so Krishna is the divine charioteer. Krishna also, you will see if you just Google Krishna and look for images of Krishna, he is associated with playing a flute. Krishna will often be either holding a flute in one of his multiple hands, or he'll actually be playing the flute. Why is he playing the flute? Because he's associated with that constellation that has this pipe. You can see it out there in the night sky. And then behind Krishna is a constellation that looks like a tent or a canopy. And this is actually, if you look at the images of the war carts in the Mahabharata or the, you know, the ancient India, these battles, their chariots are actually, they look kind of like a little tent on wheels. And that little tent, I believe, is the constellation. I don't know. Do you know which one I'm thinking of? It's sad that we're not really, you know, we're not really taught constellations
right.
in school. There, you know, it's like, hey, this is a totally almost free hobby. You can go out every night and walk your dog or whatever, you know, and look at the night sky and start to become more and more familiar. But anyway, it's kind of like adding vocabulary in another language, kind of
sure.
learn one constellation and learn another. You don't have to try and do it all at once. Anyway, Ophiuchus, the serpent handler or the serpent bearer, is a large constellation. He's right over Scorpio. And I believe that is the war cart of Krishna and Arjun. And just above Ophiuchus, standing on the head of Ophiuchus, so to speak, is the constellation Hercules. And Hercules is, you know, this massive, very large, got a big square head. This is Hanuman. Hanuman, the ape god, carries a mace, right? Hercules carried a big club, mm-hmm. right? The constellation Hercules has a huge kind of scimitar-shaped or diamond-shaped weapon that he's brandishing overhead. And he also has a distinctively curved leg, which is probably the tail of Hanuman,
okay.
the monkey god. Anyway, that's right above the war cart. So you can see this whole thing in the sky. And actually, Hercules is at the top of the brightest side of the Milky Way. The brightest portion of the Milky Way rises up between Scorpio and Sagittarius. You can see that in the summer months here in the Northern Hemisphere. It's our summer time. You can start to see now, as we're speaking here in April of 2016, you can see Scorpio in the early morning. If you get up at 4:30 or 5 a.m. and go out, you'll see brilliant Scorpio. And the column of the Milky Way rises up through Scorpio all the way up, and Hercules is up at the top. That's this endless banner, I believe, that when they talk about the banner being endless, that Hanuman is above the war cart in this special banner that's in the Bhagavad Gita and the Mahabharata. That is Hercules at the top of the Milky Way. It's a lot easier if I were to sketch it out and show it
sure.
to you. I kind of do that in the book. Actually, these volumes, I present the myth kind of in the first half, or the literal details of the story with some pictures, if I can, you know, find some pictures. And then I provide some clues, like, okay, what could play this banner that's above the chariot? Notice the tail, or notice that Hanuman carries a mace or whatever. And those are some clues that you might want to pay attention to. And then when you're ready, turn to page 355. So each chapter is kind of broken into two halves. The first half, it's kind of like a puzzle, gives you some clues. And then the second half, I'll show the diagrams of the star charts. And I use the, Planetarium app, Stellarium, that mm-hmm. is an open source app that anyone can download onto their computer. You can use it online, and you can see these constellations. They're right there. It's like the evidence is right there. So
sure.
A lot of people would say, I don't believe this, or, how could all these myths around the world be using this same system when they all speak different languages, or they're in different centuries or even different millennia? Well, you can actually see the clues in the texts and stories themselves, and then you can look in the constellations. It's right there. It's verifiable, if you will.
And I liked the way that you set up the book, because then not only are you presenting the myth and then presenting your interpretation of it, but it almost seems like you are coaching or mentoring somebody to learn how to kind of analyze these myths on their own accord as well. And I think that's incredible, because, you know, most of the books about alternative historical theory, while they're incredible and I find them fascinating, it's very much one-sided in terms of, you know, here's the research that I did, here's the data that I acquired, and here's my interpretation of the data. I like your approach, because like I said, it's like you're almost coaching your readers to become more analytically driven in terms of analyzing these myths, right? So I think that's fascinating.
Well, thanks. Absolutely. Thanks for that. And I would say that's really an important point, because what I want to encourage people to do is go to the stars yourself and go to the myths yourself. Because when people say, well, what does it mean? Well, I can tell you what I think it means. And I do think that there are some answers to that, and we can talk about it later if we have time. But you shouldn't really care what I think it means.
Sure.
go ask the myths yourself. That's what, but in order to be able to go ask them, you have to be able to speak their language.
Right.
And so I really encourage people, because I do believe these myths were given to humanity as this precious inheritance, this ancient treasure. And some cultures were fortunately, by history, able to keep them from being taken from them or stamped out for many centuries, right up to the present day.
Right.
And in many other parts of the country, they were stamped out, parts of the world, sorry, they were stamped out. But anyway, we can go and ask the myths, hey, what are you trying to tell me? Because I do believe they have something to tell each and every person.
Right. You know, across the world, we find enigmatic and sometimes unexplainable megalithic structures, and I believe that these structures, you know, they basically present us with a paradigm that the conventional view of history is flawed, right? And I know we talk about uniformitarian views on this show quite often. So what most people don't know is that the myths found all over the world, they also show evidence of being part of a single ancient coherent system. And that stretches literally all across the globe. We do have to take a quick break, David, but when we come back, I want to dig into that a bit more and kind of get your take on that. So we will be right back in just a moment. All right, welcome back to Lost Origins. I'm your host, Andrew, and if you're just joining us, today we are chatting with author David Matheson regarding his research of ancient myths and their connection to the stars. Fascinating, fascinating stuff. So make sure that if you are just joining us after the show, hop back on and listen to the first half, because you don't want to miss out on that. So David, before the break, you were explaining to us the mythological connection of Lord Krishna to the stars, which I thought was fascinating. But we started to talk a little bit about megalithic structures all across the globe, and how there is evidence of this being part of a single ancient coherent system. Where do you think that came from? How can we observe this evidence? And basically, what does it tell us, right? Like, it definitely seems to suggest some major problems within the conventional historical narrative.
Great, great subject and question, Andrew. And, you know, I think it's, you know, I just want to congratulate you on your podcast, and I think great that you named it Lost Origins, because that's actually an incredibly important question. And the archaeological evidence around the world that you mentioned really suggests that we're living inside a vast ruined architecture. And that's not my poetic phrase. That's the authors of Hamlet's Mill, which was written in 1969, said, it seems like we're living inside of a vast ruined musical instrument or something. And they're actually talking about the myths. But so the myths are another piece of evidence that we are living inside some sort of an ancient structure that we don't even perceive or we don't understand, and we don't really know what it was for. There's lots of theories, but what's really interesting is that these ancient archaeological sites, many of which are so incredibly precise, and you've had guests on that talk about the amazing masonry that you can't put a dollar bill in between the stones right. of Sacsayhuaman, and the stones will go around a corner, which is these huge polygonal or polygonal, 12-sided stone going around a corner, and you find that in Peru, modern day Peru and Bolivia, and then you find it on Easter Island, and then you find it in Egypt.
Right.
That seems to suggest that there's some kind of either they all popped up independently, or there was some kind of ancient lost culture, or maybe it was even before any of the cultures that we have history of. Okay, so there's also that same sort of evidence within the myths. And there's some actual evidence that the two do have some connections. You will see that the myths or the people who talk about, like Graham Hancock talks about this, some of the pyramids in Central America, the traditional, the Maya who are there today, they're still Maya people, will tell you, that was put up overnight, or we're told by our ancestors that was put up overnight by a dwarf with a flute. Or playing a musical instrument.
Sure.
That's interesting. We were just talking about a celestial figure with a flute. Okay. Also, a lot of these ancient structures, like the Great Pyramid, but also, I talk a lot about them in the Matheson Corollary and some of my previous books or on my blog, will have what are called precessional numbers encoded into their dimensions or their proportions.
Right.
And precession is another one of those great heavenly cycles. And it actually, there's processional numbers encoded in many systems of martial art, and the motions that we make as human beings reflect the motions of what's going on in the heavens. Mm. Like when we're doing, if you do Tai Chi, there's a long form of Tai Chi that has 108 movements. Well, if you're doing those movements, you're lining yourself up either consciously or unconsciously with the heavenly cycles. You're reenacting heavenly cycles in your life. It's as above, so below,
right.
Which, we could spend a whole show on that, but even just celebrating our birthday is a way of lining up with heavenly cycles or the different festivals of the year or holy days in the various cultures. Okay. So, it's like we're living inside this vast ruined architecture. Your question is, where did it come from? My discovery of these, the system in the myths, and I'm not the first to talk about this. Plato talks about this.
Mm-hmm.
There's people in the 1800s, we could mention some of their names, that talk about this. It's actually the metaphor of a ruined structure is actually a good one, because it's kind of like these myths, if you think of them as this vast archaeological structure as well, it's kind of like there's been people throughout time who said, hey, there's something going on in these myths that seems to be celestial, but they didn't necessarily tell you the whole thing. Or they'll say, it's like I kind of got fascinated by that, and I camped out in the myths, in the stars, and I said, Plato talks about this, or Robert Taylor in the 1800s talks about this, or Hamlet's Mill talks about this. And Hamlet's Mill is actually a very confusing book. They don't systematically lay anything out for you. They kind of tease the reader.
Hmm.
But they're saying, hey, there's something here. You figure out what it is. Well, I got fascinated by that. And the more I look at it, it's like I kind of became obsessed with it and mapped it out on, all over my house, like you see in the movies, it's almost
right.
Like, and I'm thinking about it and thinking about it. And all of a sudden I said, wait a minute, if it's kind of like there's this structure underneath the jungle, and you say, oh, wow, this little doorway that Plato talks about, if that's right, then there should be maybe another doorway around here on the other side of this forest. Then you go over there and you find the evidence of another doorway. You go, oh, I think I'm starting to see the system. I think there really is something here. And then pretty soon, it's like this thing starts rising up out of the sand and out of the jungle and from underneath the snow. And you go, oh my goodness, this structure is actually worldwide. And you can see it in the myths of the Americas, and you can see it in the Pacific. So where did it come from? I think The answer to that is, I don't know, but it is from somebody who was very spiritually advanced, because we can talk about what these things mean. I think they are actually profound truths that can apply to our life, whether it's in sports or just, day-to-day life, the way, but these messages are very profound, and they're in there. We know they're profound. People go to the Bible and say, oh, there's beauty and truth here. People are attracted to it, or the Bhagavad Gita, or the Tao Te Ching. There is some ancient wisdom there,
right,
that we are attracted to, and whoever gave it to humanity, or humanity, I'm not going to say I know where it came from. I don't think anyone can say they know where it came from. It could be that people were able to tap into the spiritual realm, in the shamanic worldview, just to use that term as a way of explaining that the worldview that there's a spiritual realm, and here we are in the physical realm, but it seems that we actually have a spiritual component. And in fact, there's something that interpenetrates even rocks and trees that seems to have a spiritual component, or there's an invisible realm. That worldview is actually present,
right,
in all the myths of the world, including the Bible. I mean, in the letters of the Apostle Paul, he'll say, well, I was in the spirit. I was in Christ, and he'll talk about going off to these other realms, mm-hmm. The prophet Daniel will talk about. So this this idea of another realm, or you ask the peoples of the Amazon how they could possibly have come up with this particular medicinal plant use, and they say, well, the plants told us.
Right.
Well, we know the plants don't tell us things kind of in our ordinary reality. What are they talking about? Somehow they have access to a reality where they can talk to plants, or where they can gain knowledge. So there's certain things that we can only gain by going to a different way of seeing and hearing.
Right.
It's possible that these myths came from a previous civilization, or a previous type of humans that was much more fluent in crossing over to that realm. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It could be from outside influence. It could be from some ancient civilization, like, I make quotation marks with my fingers, Atlantis. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting that some of the myths of Central America, the indigenous people themselves, the traditions say they came from these people called the Tulan or the Tulan, mm-hmm. who came across the ocean. Well, Tulan, as some researchers have pointed out, does linguistically seem to have some connections to the same word Atlantis.
Right.
So was there some ancient lost civilization? It's also possible that a civilization went around and influenced all these other civilizations. But I think that hypothesis, so I think the short answer is, I think we should entertain all the possible explanations for the evidence that we find and say, okay, how does this one stack up against the evidence? How does this one stack up? We should keep an open mind, like you say at the end of your show, sometimes question everything.
Right.
Don't settle on one and say, oh, I refuse to listen to any other possibilities. I don't think that's a good way to find the truth.
Right.
So I think there's a lot of possibilities, but I don't think these are just independent gropings of, the conventional attitude is, well, when we were really, really early humans, we didn't know where thunderstorms came from, so we made up a thunder god to try and explain it.
Right.
And then later on, that got more and more spiritually advanced, and then eventually they became these really spiritually deep things like the Bhagavad Gita or the Tao Te Ching. No, I don't think that actually matches the evidence that we see at all.
Right.
I think they are spiritually advanced all the way around the world. They have profound things to tell us, no matter where they are. And they're also found across the millennia. So I don't think it's likely that it was one group like the Egyptians just sailing around and taking their system everywhere else. I think what it looks more like is that they descended from some common, very ancient source, but they really diverged in their outward details, but that they're all related.
Right. You know, Laird Scranton, he was on the show not too long ago, and we talked about Göbekli Tepe as being our point of origin. And he, one of his theories, views Göbekli Tepe as an ancient megalithic university, because all across the globe, these megalithic sites, just as you had mentioned, they do display some outstandingly eerie similarities. And so, like I've said on almost every single show, if it's a singular occurrence of something, rather easy to discredit as coincidental. But when we have multiple examples of it across the globe from ancient times, you know, that's something that warrants attention, I think. So well said. David, we're getting close to the end of the show so far. So I do want to ask you, I know you have your website out there. Is that the best place for people to connect with you and follow your work?
Oh, sure. Thanks, Andrew. So I have a website that's called starmythworld.com. If you don't remember that or you can't find it, you can just search for my name and the word stars, and you'll probably come across it. I have a blog that's, I think, up in the 870 posts or something by Holy now, cow. Maybe 860s, 870s. And that's called the Matheson Corollary. But the blog is fully searchable. So if you want to search for a certain myth, you can do that. And that blog is also located on starmythworld.com. So it's actually on the internet in a couple of places. But yeah, so starmythworld.com is kind of a new site that I'm still continuing to, construction on, but it's fully up and running and you can check it out. And there's a lot of resources there. There's myths. There's a whole section of myths that you can click on whichever story you want and read some things about it or see some of the videos that I've made. And so that's probably the best best way to find out that stuff. And you can, and just to riff on what you said about Göbekli Tepe a little bit, just for a second, mm-hmm. It's just so amazing. If the dating that we're being told is correct, it's as ancient, 6,000, 7,000 years before the conventional dating of the pyramids.
Right.
You know, whether the conventional dating of the pyramids is right or not, we could talk about for hours too, but,
sure.
But that would mean that it's as ancient as the pyramids are to us. Göbekli Tepe was that ancient when the pyramids were built.
Right.
And by the way, when you look at some of these incredible pillars at Göbekli Tepe, these key pillars, some of them have these hands that are almost touching with long fingers in front, like in front of their belly button, so to speak, level. Well, if you look at the heads on Easter Island, you will see they're actually long bodies. They actually do have torsos, like Thor Heyerdahl
right.
has a whole book. And they have the same fingertips almost touching in front of their navels that these pillars at Göbekli Tepe have, which is mind-boggling. I mean, we could talk about that for hours as well.
Yeah, it's crazy the similarities we find all across the globe. And honestly, that's why we started the show, was just to objectively discuss those with people all across the world, basically. David, do you have any speaking engagements coming up? Any events that you're going to be at that our listeners should be aware of?
Great. Thanks for asking, Andrew. Yes, I'm going, looking very much forward to being at the conference on precession and ancient knowledge, which is CPAK, so it's sometimes called CPAC, 2016. I believe this is the 10th one.
Right.
That's held in Southern California. It's actually near Coachella in the Palm Desert area. And we're also going to try, weather permitting, to go out and look at the stars. And I'll point out some of these constellations. Maybe you've never identified the constellation Ophiuchus, out in the night sky by yourself. So I'll try and point that out so that everybody can see it and talk and be talking about the myths. And that is on the weekend that begins on Friday, September 30th, which is actually a day of the new moon, mm-hmm. which means that's the best you know, that's some of the best times for watching, looking for the stars is when the moon is not up. You know, when we have a full moon, it's almost like the sun is up in the middle of the day, night. But so we're going to try and do that. And because it's the desert, we probably will have a pretty good clear sky to look at the stars. But there are other speakers will be there, like Scott Onstott, who does Secrets in Plain Sight, those videos. And Robert Schock, who did some of the dating on the Sphinx, you know, the discussion of the age of the Sphinx at Giza that was discussed in John Anthony West's Serpent in the Sky back in the 70s, a very seminal work that's a very important work. Robert Schock's going to be there, along with lots of other speakers, Walter Cruttenden, who talks about precession and Sirius, the star Sirius, et cetera. So that's in September of 2016. If your listeners are able to come to that, that'd be great. I'm really looking forward to it.
That's going to be an awesome event. I hope to see you there. David, thank you so much for coming on the show. I look forward to inviting you back on hopefully many times in the future. I've thoroughly enjoyed our conversation today.
Likewise, Andrew. Thanks very much. I really enjoyed it, and thanks for having me on. And I hope that all your listeners will become excited about the myths and go ask the myths for themselves.
Very good. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this week's episode of Lost Origins. Get online, check out David's work, check out his website, head over to Amazon and pick up one of his books. I know you will not be disappointed. You want to make sure that you tune in next week for our show when we're going to be bringing on William Mann. William's work is absolutely fascinating. His work surrounds pre-Columbian contact and Templar presence here in the Americas. So make sure you guys hit that subscribe button. Never miss an episode or an article from your friends here at Lost Origins. And until next time, I'm your host, Andrew, and I want you to continue to question everything.